chaos of the world today, people are calling for love to overcome hate. But how exactly do we do this? Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. Our guest today will have an answer for you for what many find to be a compelling question and many fear a question for which there is no true answer. Join me in welcoming Jenny Lee, author of Breathing Love, Meditation in Action. Jenny Lee is a certified yoga therapist, and she's worked with a wide range of clients from ages 6 to 94. Jenny Lee, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thanks so much, Dr. Brewer. It's great to be here today.
Now, Jenny, tell me what a certified yoga therapist, what does that actually mean?
So most people are familiar with yoga classes where they go and do a lot of different movements that feel great for the body and calm the mind a bit. But a yoga therapist is someone who works with the traditional texts of the yoga tradition and works on both the physical body, the mind, the emotional state, and then recognizing also that we're spiritual beings. So it's a very holistic therapeutic practice that is individualized. So it's a one-to-one session usually, and just, helping people to overcome the stressors and tensions in their lives on all different levels, using the traditions and practices and philosophies of classical yoga.
I note that you have worked with clients from the ages of 6 to 94. So that's quite a range. And we understand people being stressed, and we are certainly more aware of younger people experiencing stress. But is there an age at which yoga is not appropriate? Is there a age that's too young, or is there an age that's too old and yoga is not going to be the thing that's going to be useful?
No, actually, if you can breathe, you can do yoga. So yoga, really, we need to expand the awareness of what that is. It's not just the physical movements. It's really a philosophy of life. And many of the practices have to do with how we manage our minds, how we manage our energy. So again, I've worked with people who are days away from dying. I have worked with hospice organizations, and I've also worked with very small children. So if you're breathing, you can do yoga, seriously. So it's far more than standing on your head or twisting yourself into a pretzel.
So there's hope for all of us.
Yes, absolutely.
You say that it's time to stop the unfulfilling quest to get the love you want and realize what? Why is it time to stop the unfulfilling quest?
Well, if you think about it, we are constantly moving towards the things that we think we want, and we're trying to avoid the things we don't want. So it's this dance that we go through of like and dislike, and every day, all day long. And in the yoga tradition, they say this is what keeps us suffering, because we're never fully satisfied. And even if we get what we think we want, it's only satisfactory for a period of time. And then we're on to the next desire. And so there's no real lasting fulfillment in the external world of things. And so the unfulfilling quest towards the love that we want is that we're looking for it outside of ourselves. And the premise of my book, Breathing Love, is that love is the energy that lives within us, and that we'll only find true satisfaction and a true connection to love when we look inward rather than outward. And I'm sure we can elaborate on that, but that's the short answer to that question.
You mentioned the name of your book, Breathing Love, which is the main title. Subtitle, Meditation in Action. We don't think about meditation in terms of it being an action. We think about meditation, I think most of us, in terms of it being an inaction. It's just something you do when you're sitting still and you're calm. So talk to me about meditation in action. What do you mean by that?
Sure. So Meditation, it has become a very popular practice, and there are lots of different forms of meditation. And some of them are, in fact, active practices, such as a walking meditation, where you're being very mindful with each step, or a guided meditation where you're going through a lot of visualizations, let's say. But that's actually not what I'm referring to in the subtitle, so I appreciate you asking. What I'm talking about in the subtitle, meditation in action, means that we take the qualities that we cultivate during our seated meditation, and I do practice a seated still meditation in the tradition of classical yoga, but I'm there to connect to the love in my own being. I'm there to quiet my mind and to become more peaceful, to connect to my intuition so I can become more authentic. And so then the action part is when I step away from my meditation cushion, living and embodying those qualities that I've cultivated during my practice, because it doesn't do me or anybody else any good if I take that half an hour in the morning to cultivate peacefulness while I'm sitting there, but then I get up and I yell at my kids, or I cut somebody off on my way to work, or, you know, I'm just not a very nice human being out in the world. I really have to embody the qualities that I'm cultivating during my practice.
It sounds wonderful. It sounds peaceful. It sounds really hard to do, particularly, you know, in today's world where there's just seems to be so much anger, so much hatred, quite frankly, so much intolerance. How do you take the practice from the stillness of your own work out into the external world?
Well, I think because of the state of fear and anger and stress and that is present in the world today, it is even more important that each one of us take these moments to quiet down the reactive mind. It's very natural for us to move into reactivity. It's what human beings do. We're in that constant, like I said, that dance between attaching to what we like and being aversive to that which we don't. And so there's all this polarization going on, not only in our own minds, but between us as individuals. And so it's really, really more important than ever that we take time to drop back behind this pattern of reactivity, this bouncing between the two states, and recognize that there's more. There's more to us. We are the awareness that sits behind those reactions. We have the capacity to choose our reaction rather than have it just flare up and we go along for the ride. And so it's really just, I think, essential more than ever that we each take bits of time to do this so that we can be more conscious in how we treat one another and how we make choices in our daily life.
The idea of being able to make choices about one's own reactions, again, that's something that for many people just doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. I mean, how often do we hear people say, well, that's just how I feel, period. I'm just saying how I feel. That's the deal.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we can't necessarily help how we feel. Feelings happen. They're like waves of the ocean. They come and then they go. And feeling states are constantly changing. So the anger that I might have felt yesterday isn't necessarily the same at the same level or even there today. And so what we can recognize through a meditation practice is that these feeling states that arise are not who we are. They're just experiences that are passing through us, just like our thoughts are moments of an experience that are passing through our minds, and they're not equivalent to who we actually are at the foundation of our being. And so what meditation teaches us is this ability to what I call step back or step behind those changing feeling states or changing thought states, and recognize that there is an awareness that's watching all of that. It's often referred to as witnessing or witness consciousness, where we just, I mean, I've gone to my meditation cushion incredibly angry, like at the point of feeling like my head was going to blow off because I was in conflict with someone. And I'm thinking of one particular instance where I sat down and I was literally fuming. I could feel heat in my body. I could feel tightness in my gut. I could feel just a pounding in my head. And I sat down and I started breathing and I just quieted the breath and I just kept breathing and kept breathing. And it's like mud settling in a glass of water. You know, you throw some dirt into a glass of water and it's all swirly, swirly. And then if you just let it sit there, eventually that mud is going to drift down to the bottom and then there's going to be clarity in the water above it. Well, the same thing happens in our internal state. If we sit and we breathe and we consciously quiet down the breath and quiet down that reactivity, then we start to move back into clarity. And I was able to leave that meditation feeling a whole lot better inside my own body and also able to make that conscious choice that we were just talking about how I was going to respond to the individual that I was having a disagreement with. And I was able to respond in a calm and compassionate way rather than in an angry and just defensive way.
So it sounds like the practice of meditation can in fact be quite powerful in our lives, and it's something over which we have control.
Absolutely. We have control over every reaction that is occurring in ourselves. We have the control over whether we're going to allow that reaction to stay or whether we're going to ask it to leave. And so the practice of breathing love, which is the title of my book, is a conscious practice because we all have these reactions to circumstances, events, people, et cetera. And then we have to say, all right, well, is that reaction what I want to keep? Do I really want to respond from anger and defensiveness and hatred? Or do I want to respond from love? And I know for me, I've done both in my life. We all have. And responding from love feels way better, way better. It feels better to me. It feels better to the other person. It creates a harmony in which we can come to compromise and understanding. It doesn't continue to fuel and facilitate more conflict, which if I responded in anger and defensiveness would continue to create more misunderstanding and conflict. And so, yeah, it's a choice. It is a choice and we all have it and we have to take it and not just allow the feeling states to run the show.
You talk about learning how to love beyond one's current limitations. And I think about any number of the conflicts that arise today. And very often the confrontations can be so intense. They can be so full of energy that the idea of in sort of instilling love within that interaction not only doesn't feel good, but kind of feels like a bit of a weakness and a de-energizing of oneself. That's not true.
I would say that's not true, actually, not in my experience. I find that love is actually a very powerful force. There's nothing weak about the choice of love. Actually, it takes an incredible amount of strength to choose it, especially in times of conflict. So I actually posted a little quote yesterday that said, you don't have to like someone in order to love them. And this is something that I really hold on to every day because there are people both in my personal world and also in the political world that I don't like. And I don't agree with their actions. I don't agree with their values. But my practice of conscious loving is beyond that. It's a choice that I make to see that beyond that person's differences is a soul. And at the soul level, I can love them because we are all connected at the soul level. We're all part of the one consciousness that all of this created reality around us is. And so I look try to look beyond the differences and beyond the actions or choices that I don't agree with personally. And I try to bring that more universal love to the table at a soul level so that I don't have to continue to stay in a state of disharmony in my own being when I think of that person. So this is what I mean by loving beyond our current capacity. So if I'm just coming from my own little personality self, there's going to be all those differences. But if I'm transcending that and I'm going to a more universal love state, then I'm able to embrace everyone, even those who have different values than I may hold. And I still may take actions in my outer world to change things that I feel need changing, but I don't do it from a state of aggressiveness or hatred. I do it from a state of, well, I feel that this is the higher, more loving place that we can come to, so I'm going to work towards that. And that way I retain peacefulness within my own being as I'm working towards change.
So it's not that you have to agree with the person or like the person's behaviors. You kind of look beyond that to the fact, it sounds like that they're a human being and that we're all sort of human beings.
Exactly. I mean, we all have blood and breath and we're made of the same stuff. And so regardless of your politics or your race or your country, it doesn't matter. We are all part of one human family. And, you know, this is what's missing in our world today is that this recognition, because if we were to recognize one another as one human family, we would be making far different choices on all levels in terms of how we treat one another. And so this begins at the individual level in how I deal with the people in my world, my circle of influence, that may or may not hold the same values as I do, or maybe making choices. And, you know, for me, forgiveness is another word for love. And forgiveness is dependent upon seeing beyond the action. So what we're not forgiving the action. There are many actions that are taken that are, you know, unfathomable, right? What humans do to other humans. But
indeed.
So we're not forgiving the action. We're forgiving the soul that is beyond that is behind the action, that is has gone into such a state of ignorance and delusion and forgetting their own true nature that they were capable of taking that action. So really we're recognizing that the people who are doing really terrible things have fallen so far away from knowing their own true nature that we have to forgive the soul. We're not forgiving the action.
So again, the idea of forgiveness is something that we're doing for ourselves. It broadens our ability to make choices and decisions about interacting with that person, but also interacting with the world around us. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and we don't always have to interact with someone who has, you know, deeply hurt us or might not be safe to be around, but we can overcome the pain and the hatred and or the fear or whatever that is within our own being that prevents us from feeling love through forgiveness of that other being, that other human being. Forgiveness is really a practice that we do for ourselves, not for anyone else. And it's what frees us from those uncomfortable states of being.
Having a conversation with Jenny Lee, author of True Yoga and author of Breathing Love, Meditation in Action. We will take a break, but we will return in just a moment and continue this conversation with Jenny Lee. Don't go away, folks. talking about meditation, the value of meditation, how to put meditation in action. But it occurs to me that we haven't talked about the actual, how does one get involved in a meditative stance? What exactly is meditation? Can anyone meditate? You talked about getting off your meditation cushion. Do you have to have tools and supplies, or help us out for the novice? The total novice knows nothing about meditation.
Sure. For the total novice. So you can meditate anywhere. You can sit in a chair. You could sit on the floor. You don't have to have any special equipment. Really, the way I teach meditation comes from the tradition of yoga philosophy, and it does ask that we have an upright spine. So people often ask, can I do it laying down? Well, if you have a physical handicap of some kind that prevents you from sitting upright, then yes, do it laying down or in whatever position you're in. But if you have the capacity to sit upright, they would recommend that you have an upright spine for the movement of energy to be best. But sit in whatever way is comfortable for you. And then it's just simply taking your attention inward. So closing your eyes, quieting your environment. And I start by offering people the practice of just paying attention to the breath, because that's something that's always within us. And it's easy to concentrate the mind on the movement of the breath through the body. And then so what we're trying to do in meditation is to quiet the restless mind down a bit. We're not going to turn the mind off. There's no off button, unfortunately, but we can direct our attention to a single point. So the breath is often the first point of attention that we might direct the mind towards. So paying attention, the feeling of the breath, where is the breath moving in the body? Can you feel it down in your belly? Can you feel it in your chest? Is it getting stuck anywhere? What's the quality of the breath? These kind of things. And then as you're paying attention to that, you'll notice that you're able to breathe a little deeper or a little longer, and then the body starts to relax a little bit more, and maybe the mind is a little quieter. And then over time, what you'll notice is, well, the mind scatters off to what it's going to have for dinner that night or what you have to accomplish at work today. And then you have to bring it back and go, no, just, you know, like you guide a child back from a distracted activity. It's like, no, mind, we're going to just come back. We're just going to focus on the breath right now, just for a little while. And I usually tell people to set a timer for whatever amount of time feels comfortable for them, maybe 5 or 10 minutes to begin, so that they know this is how long I'm going to sit and this is how long I'm going to focus on my breath. And you just keep coming back. And it's this practice of cultivating that single point of attention so that the mind and the body quiet. And then what occurs over time is that you start to really enjoy those peaceful moments, and it feels more natural and comfortable to sit there quietly with your eyes closed, focusing on your breath, which at first might feel a little strange for somebody if they've never done that. But over time, it starts to feel really nice, and it's like a little timeout from the outer focus and kind of that chaotic responsiveness that we all are expected to have in the world today. You know, we're bombarded with stimuli and things that emails and social media and things we have to respond to and reply to. And it's just a break. It's a break for the mind. It's a resting time for the mind. So I don't know. Does that help?
Absolutely. You know, as you're describing it, I mean, it certainly sounds lovely and peaceful. And then I think about the people who were working in these open concept floor plan buildings or offices. You know, there was a time when people had an office and you could close the door, and it was easy to do that if you made yourself do that. With having these open plans where everybody's sharing a cubicle and there's something going on all the time, can you do meditation in that kind of environment? Or do you really need to wait until you get home or someplace where you can sort of attend to yourself in a different way?
Yeah, I think it would probably be difficult to do in an open concept office environment because I think people would have the expectation that you're available to be, communicated with there. So you might need to take time. Let's say you take public transportation to work. Well, yes, you're surrounded by people, but they're not necessarily people who are going to talk to you or expect something of you. So I think it could be easier to do, let's say, on a train than in an open concept office. So as long as you don't have people that are expecting anything of you, I think you could take a few minutes and sit wherever. But ideally, sure, in a home space or in a quiet space, maybe your car. If you drive to work, you could park your car 5 minutes before you have to get out of it to go into the office, and you could just sit in your parked car. I've even had people go to the bathroom if that's the only place that they can have a couple of minutes of solitude and just be there and breathe and center themselves. So I think it just depends on what somebody has available to them, but certainly a place that is going to not be pulling at you with outer distractions, phones, conversations, et cetera.
The rest of life.
Yeah.
Does meditation help for someone who's really struggling with anxiety and fear?
So that's a really interesting question, and my answer is yes. However, when someone is in a state of anxiety or fear, and I work with many clients who struggle in that way, you're not going to be able to go immediately from that into a quiet meditative state. So when I have a client come in who is very anxious or very fearful, what I'm going to do first is I'm going to help them to relax. And so I'll do a conscious relaxation practice with them, which will have to do with controlling the breath, slowing the breath down, scanning through the body mentally to identify places where there's tension or there's energy that's really tight or agitated, and then moving the breath into that body part and intentionally relaxing it. So we need to help the mind and the body get out of the kind of fight or flight state of that comes when we feel those feelings of anxiety or fear. So relaxation first, then maybe moving in towards a more traditional meditation practice. The other thing I'll address here that comes up for some people when they start meditation is that they're really not used to being with themselves and their own inner world. And if there has been any kind of trauma or just difficulty, really, that those and they move their attention inward, they can sometimes have like a re-experiencing of those traumatic states. And so you want to be sure that if that's your experience, that maybe you work with a therapist or a coach or someone who is trained to help you with processing audibly what the trauma has been in your past experience so that you don't have to go through that alone. But what I will say is that although when we turn our attention inward and we feel those things that maybe we've repressed at the time that they occurred, it is very valuable to go ahead and revisit them in a supportive environment so that we can then release them and get again back to the capacity of sitting in stillness with ourselves and find peace within, because that's obviously what we all want to feel is a sense of inner peace.
I noticed that you specifically said audible processing if you're going to work through the trauma. Why?
Well, I think it's important to give voice to feelings if there has been trauma. People need to be heard in their feelings. So part of what I do is I do a dialogue process with people, as well as coaching them in the meditation practices. So I think that we have to acknowledge that we have feelings about the experiences of our lives, and we need to be heard and held in a compassionate container by someone who can facilitate acknowledging those feelings and helping us to understand the experience and to, you know, wrap some context around it.
You know, I know that you know that there are so many people who have said post a trauma, I don't want to talk about it. I just want to forget about it. And clearly what you're saying is that that's not a very loving way to treat yourself or to facilitate your own healing. Not talking about it doesn't work.
Well, not talking about it doesn't work forever. We may need to take a little space from it. But in my experience in working with many, 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 many clients over the years who have had some very heavy, heavy traumas, those experiences and the feelings that we have based on those experiences live within us. They live in our bodily tissues. I mean, there's a saying, our biography becomes our biology. And to me, that is very true. I see people every day whose bodies are exhibiting the symptoms of unprocessed trauma. And so it is very important, I think, if you have had a traumatic experience, to seek counsel and to go through the feeling process about what that was, as painful as that will be. And one thing that a therapist told me long ago when I was working through some of my own traumatic experiences was that, you know, I've already survived them. So if I'm sitting in the therapist's office, the worst has already happened. The trauma is behind me. I'm a survivor. And so whatever revisiting of the feelings that I might do in that therapeutic time is not going to be nearly as bad as the trauma itself. So we have to recognize that we are strong. We have incredible capacity as human beings to be resilient and to overcome. And we've done it again and again, every single one of us. And collectively, we all are survivors. And so knowing that and empowering ourselves with the awareness that we have capacity of resilience and that we have an incredible well of love within our hearts that is untapped. So going back to that question you asked about loving beyond our current capacity, well, there might be a lot of blocks to our capacity to love because we've been hurt or betrayed or whatever, that we might be feeling those blocks right now. But if we can release those blocks, then we start to free ourselves back into a state not only of greater peace but of greater love, and that's a much better place to live.
It's a more powerful, peaceful, in some respects easier way to live.
Absolutely, because it takes a lot of energy to stuff feelings down and to not talk about them and not feel them. It takes a tremendous amount of energy. It's like putting a dam up on a tsunami wave or something.
You talked about a conversation with your mother. This is something that you share in Breathing Love. And you talked to your mother about the purpose of her life as she was despairing that she had no purpose. Can you tell us a little bit about that conversation?
Yeah, it was such a beautiful moment. My mom was had fairly close to her time of passing, and she was in a nursing home. She was fairly incapacitated physically, and she was no longer able to do the activities that had given her joy and meaning, like her art or her church. And so she was really feeling great despair, like, why am I even here? She even said, why am I even here? I might as well just die. And I said, Mom, you're here. We are all here to love and to be love. And you can offer your loving presence to the people right here in this nursing home, the person in the bed next to you, the nurse who comes in to change your sheet, whatever, whoever you're interacting with. I feel the greatest purpose of any one of our lives is to love and to be loved. And she took that in. She thought about it for a while, and she had a very profound experience in the nursing home of overcoming some racial bigotry that she had held for her whole life. And she made friends with a person of a different color than she was, and that would never have happened in her earlier life. But it was because she opened her heart to love and to engaging with the person who was in front of her, and she was no longer seeing skin color. She was just seeing a human that she wanted to love, and they actually became, she became friends with this nurse, and it was so beautiful to see. Just really the power of love and what purpose that gave her in her heart, and how she felt so uplifted by it, by, yeah, engaging that practice.
Powerful indeed.
Yeah. Yeah. If we could all do more of that, right? The world would be a different place.
Oh, would it ever? But of course, that's another conversation and another program. You also say that love can soften loss. And even as you were talking about your mom and the loving way in which you talked to her and the love that she was able to share with someone else, your voice softened. It really is interesting how powerful love can be in so many different arenas.
It really is. And I'll share another story about my mom if we have time. And at her time of near passing, we all have different relationships with our parents. And my one with my mom was tumultuous at times. And we had many differences and many disagreements. And I, you know, as many grown children feel, our parents didn't give us enough or give love in the way that we needed it or whatever. And I had done lots of therapy on this, but here she is basically on her deathbed, and I'm still feeling resentment towards her over ways in which I feel she didn't show up for me in life. And then I, at a certain point, just let it all go. And I said, you know, I'm not going to get from her what I think I needed. All I want to do really at this moment is just love her. And I want to feel the love that she has for me. And I want that to be the only thing left between us. And when I made that mental shift and I stopped looking for something, you know, that getting something from the outside, getting the love from the other person, I stopped doing that. That's that unfulfilling quest that we started off talking about today. And I just showed up in love with her. We had such a profoundly different experience of one another in her final days. And I was left with nothing but love in my heart. All the resentments, all the things that I felt, you know, upset about over the course of my life just disappeared. I am not even kidding you. Gone from my being. And from her dying day until now, it's been several years, whenever I think of her, the only thing in my heart is love. I never think about the things that she didn't do or the things that I was mad about or whatever. I only think of her in love. So it really did soften my heart to make that shift. And it feels way better than, you know, holding her accountable and, you know, trying to get something that I'll never get, certainly at this point.
Absolutely. Jenny, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, you yourself have experienced many transitions, and I'd like to start with that as we come back. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We will return with Jenny Lee, author of Breathing Love, Meditation in Action, in just a moment.
Thank you.
have experienced many transitions in your life. And so, as I said just before the break, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about that. An actress, a screenwriter, a wife, a mother. My goodness, talk about your own transitions.
Well, I feel like I've lived about five lives in this one lifetime. I certainly have had a lot of transitions. And one thing that I've learned about change is that I think it's much better to make conscious change than to have change thrust upon you. And I mean, sometimes we can't control it. Things happen. We lose jobs. We lose partners. People die. They leave our lives. And sometimes we have to respond to change rather than elect it. But when we can elect it, it's a lot better, even if it's difficult. And I think for me, what has gotten me through the big changes and certainly the big losses in my life is having a really clear understanding of what my core value is and core purpose. And it's really the title of the book. It's Breathing Love. It's that I want to make all of my choices and all of my responses from love, not from fear. And I call this a metta commitment, or my highest commitment in life. And so that to me is like the cairn, those cairns, the little stacks of rocks that people put along a trail. It's like a little trail marker. And so for me, to know that, to come from love, to make all my choices from love, not fear, is the trail marker. It's the guiding principle for my life. So whatever transition I'm going through, I'm looking at, well, what choices do I need to make right now from love, not fear? Does that help?
Well, somewhat. Let's just talk about, I'm going to pick one of the hats that you wore, and we'll take it from there. At one point, an actress and a screenwriter. Many people think about that as one of two ways. Either it's the most glamorous life in the world, and you know everybody, and you do everything, and money is not a problem, and who would ever want to not do that? And then there are other people who will say, that's the worst career on the planet. You're always trying to please somebody else, and it's always about what have you done for me in the next minute, and never or very rarely an acknowledgement of what you've done the minute before. So two really different perspectives, I would suggest, about the field, about the experience of being an actress and a screenwriter. How do you transit? First of all, were either one of those your experiences? And then how did you transition?
How did I transition out of that profession?
Yeah, and what was your experience of that profession?
Oh, okay. So my experience of the profession, I was never a celebrity. I was a working actor and an aspiring screenwriter. So my experience was a lot of hard work, very little money, and very little recognition. But I had joy in it. I enjoyed it for a long time. I enjoyed the acting that I did in commercials and soap operas and plays and various things. I made a transition from that at the time that my son was conceived. We left Los Angeles and moved to the East Coast because I did not want to raise him near the entertainment industry, because I do feel that it holds a lot of materialism and self-centeredness, and you know, it's a fast-paced world of Los Angeles. Although that being said, my son has moved back near Los Angeles, so we'll see how that goes now that he's an adult and an aspiring actor. But we moved east, and with the intention of having a more grounded lifestyle in a small community near my husband at the time's family. And the transition was really difficult, actually, for me, because I left a career that I was passionate about, that I had joy in, and I was very connected there, and I had activities that I enjoyed. And that transition to the East Coast, to a small town and a very, very different lifestyle, was one of the hardest of my life. In fact, I fell into a pretty, pretty darn deep depression. And I was a new mother, an infant, and So again, I mean, the way I got through it, I think, was just in continuing to come back to my highest value, which was love. And at that time, really love for my son and my husband and just the most important people in front of me, and focusing on that on a daily basis. And sometimes it's just about getting through the day, you know, and you can't really look beyond how to get through the day, especially as a new parent. It's pretty all consuming.
You know, the fact that you were able to make the decision to move away from LA to another environment because you didn't want to bring your son up in that kind of a world, I think in and of itself speaks to a foundation or a core part of who you are, independent of anything else. I mean, so many people, as you very well know, would say, I'm here, I'm not leaving, and you know, let the games begin, so to speak. But that's not who you were at your own core even then.
Right. Well, it kind of goes back to that concept of conscious change versus having change thrust upon us. Obviously, my life would have changed if I had stayed in Los Angeles as a new mother. I wouldn't have been doing the same acting that I was doing prior to having an infant. So change was coming regardless. My husband at the time also was in wanting to embrace change. So it was a conscious decision that we made together to make that big move across the country. But, and I think that it was a positive one. And, but it wasn't without difficulty for sure. And so any change is hard. Human beings tend to resist change. We don't really like change. And so we tend to avoid it. But I would personally have just learned that I would rather initiate change of my own accord than wait for it to be thrust upon me, as much as I can.
You say that when you were able to achieve a non-attachment to what you might get from work, when you allowed the ego to climb into the passenger seat and your soul got a chance to drive, that's really when your life changed in a very different, for you, in a very positive way. What do you mean about the ego climbing into the passenger seat?
I love the quotes that people pull out of books. That's one of my favorite ones because this is kind of a concept that I work with a lot. In the yoga tradition, they say that the ego, meaning our personality, should be in service to our soul. And most of the time, I'd say for most people, the ego is not really even listening to what the soul has to say. It is just running the show based on what it wants in today. And, you know, I have, like everyone else, spent a lot of my life in that place and just kind of going after what I wanted. And, but in studying the classical texts of yoga and really digging deeper into my spiritual practice, getting this concept of the soul being this overarching, you know, wise sense of ourself that really knows far better than our little limited human being self knows what we need to be doing. Shifting that, who's driving the bus? Let's put the ego over in the passenger seat and let the soul drive the bus, because that to me has brought me into much greater fulfillment. And talking about transitions, so I think that was in a chapter where I was talking about another big transition in my life, where a lot of the class work, teaching yoga classes, was kind of drying up, and I was feeling pretty discouraged and unfulfilled, and feeling like my ego was kind of battered and bruised because I'd had a certain amount of success, but then I moved across country again and started over, and nobody knew who I was, and nobody was coming to my classes. And so, you know, just having all that self-doubt. But then when I shifted perspectives and thought, okay, well, what is my soul really? How does my soul want to drive this bus? Well, my soul was really saying, like, just keep showing up. Just keep showing up in love and giving what you have to give and trust the process. And when I got out of that kind of whining mentality of I'm not getting what I want over here, and I just showed up in that more open-hearted way, then I felt a lot better. I still only might have had a couple people in my classes for a while, but I felt a lot better. And then what shifted was I got a book contract after 7 years of trying to get a book out there. I finally got a contract on my first book, True Yoga. So it's pretty powerful how just changing an internal mind state can then change things on the outside.
You, in the chapter on overcoming pain and insecurity, that is in Breathing Love, you write about a love gap. And you list examples of commonly held beliefs. Can you list some of those examples for us?
Well, yes. If you can tell me what page that's on.
Haven't got a clue, but I can help you with some of the examples that you listed.
I know what it is. Yeah, I got it.
Okay.
So the love gap is really this sense of you know, how we relate to love. And so most people have had different relationships and different experiences, and then they get hurt. And so then they form a belief like, so let's say they've had 5 breakups in a row and they've always been the one who's been left. They might form the belief, well, I'm not lovable. You know, 5 people have left me. I'm not lovable. And, or I can't trust love. You know, that's another belief. I can't trust love. And these things happen because of our experience, but I would say that there's a real circular thing that occurs, is that we have an experience, we create a belief based on that experience, but then that belief initiates the same experience to occur again. And so it's this self-feeding circle. And so what I'm doing in this chapter is I'm pointing out, like, let's break down, have people self-reflect and look at what beliefs have they created as a based on their experiences, and recognize that these beliefs, like I don't trust love or I'm not lovable, are their, that's their love gap. And so some of the examples I give are, you know, I don't fully trust love. I don't believe my needs will be met. I don't feel worthy of love. I don't feel safe in love. And so we need to recognize which ones of these, one or ones of these, we hold so that we can change them. Because as long as we hold on to them, we're going to keep feeding that circle. We're going to keep creating the same experience again and again. And change can only happen at the point of our belief system. And then as we change our beliefs, we change our experiences.
So change your belief, change your experience, change your expectations, change your experience. It sounds like you are saying we are all very powerful beings within ourselves, that we don't have to look without for the power that we already hold within.
We are incredibly powerful beings. We are so powerful, powerful beyond what we can even imagine. And the staying stuck in a state of victimhood or the belief that we are victims of some other power is one of the greatest love gaps we can possibly be in, because we all have the potential of changing at any moment in time. And we begin by changing our thought. And thought is the realm of cause. It's where everything begins. Nothing becomes manifest before a thought of it occurs. And so by changing our thought, we absolutely can change our experience. So many people have proven this, and we are, each one of us, incredibly powerful beings.
You talk about a meditation that you called love awareness. What meditation is that?
So love awareness is really this very core concept to the book. It's changing the paradigm that love is something that's outside of us that we need to go and acquire from some other person or some other experience, and changing it to recognizing, becoming aware. So the love awareness, becoming aware that we are love itself, that this is the energy of what we are made of. Love lives within us. It's not something to be gotten on the outside. And so the meditation, I believe, if it's the one I'm thinking of, because each chapter has little practices that come after the concept of the chapter is sitting and breathing and feeling deeper and deeper and deeper into your own being, into a recognition of this energy of love as who you are. Tuning into your heart center and just really recognizing that you are a part of this energy of love.
And just to let you know, the love awareness meditation is on page 39.
Yes. Thank you.
Absolutely. You're welcome. Tell us how people can learn more about what you're doing and what might be some first steps for folks.
May I give my website?
Absolutely.
Oh, okay. So my all of what I do is on my website. I do, I offer a yearly retreat, in a beautiful place somewhere on the earth. It's one of the fun things that I do each year. So this year's is sold out, but a new one will be announced soon. I, offer online courses. I do personal coaching on Skype or by the phone, all of folks all over the world. And I have my books, so everything about me and my services can be found on my website, which is my name, Jenny, J-E-N-N-I-E, Lee, L-E-E, yogatherapy.com. So Jenny Lee, yogatherapy.com. And I would love to hear from any listeners, and I'm happy to always respond and answer questions and or be of service in some other way.
Thank you very much, Jenny Lee, author of True Yoga and author of the focus of our conversation today, Breathing Love, Meditation in Action. Jenny, again, thank you so much for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk.
Thank you, Dr. Brewer. It's a pleasure talking with you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional of your choosing. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Mind Talk is available to you on demand by going to myndtalk.org. You can also download the Mind Talk app from iTunes or Google Play. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to Mind Talk right now. So do send an email to me, Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Again, that's myndtalk.org. And folks, I want you to remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.